Anyone who has ever studied to be a pilot knows that there are two types of flight rules to be followed. And which one is followed, which one is used, depends upon the surrounding conditions. There's something called visual flight rules, or VFR. VFR rules apply when there are good visibility conditions. There is no cloud cover. There is no heavy air traffic. The weather is ideal. The pilot can see the runway. He can look out of his cockpit window and he can see the runway and the taxiways, and he can see to take off and he can see to land. But that's in ideal conditions. Otherwise, instrument flight rules apply, or IFR. They need to be followed when visibility is poor, or when the weather is not so favorable. Now, IFR takes more training and additional certification. There's a lot more that goes into flying a plane when IFR is in effect. IFR requires being able to take off and land using your instruments only. Now imagine not being able to see out your window, but still you have to land this plane on this runway somewhere down below. Now, I've been on planes before where it's been very foggy or it's been raining and the plane is coming in, and I'm thinking, you know, how is this guy going to know where to land this plane? You just think these things in your head. How can they find the runway when it's so cloudy and foggy up there? You can't see anything. How do they do it? It's all done by instrument readings. The pilot must rely completely on those readings. Navigating the plane is based entirely on what they tell him, what those dials and those numbers tell him. He has to determine, am I lined up with the runway? Am I coming in at the right angle? Am I at the right altitude? Are there other aircraft nearby? All of these things have to be considered as he's coming in for a landing. The pilot can't see, so he has to place entire confidence in these instruments. And he is literally flying blind. Did you ever have to go somewhere, visit somebody, or reach a destination that you were totally unfamiliar with? Some place where you had to go where you didn't know your way around, you'd never been there before, you didn't know how to get there. Perhaps if that was the case, you navigated your way using a GPS. A GPS system that all you have to do is plug in the address to where you're going, and it will tell you how to get there. That's all you have to go by is a street address. You know nothing else. And so you go, not knowing where you are or where you're going. And you follow what the device tells you to do. If it says turn right, you turn right. If it says follow the traffic circle, you follow the traffic circle. Whatever the GPS tells you to do, you follow it, and you end up at your destination. In a sense, you too are flying blind because you don't know where you're going, and you're strictly relying on this instrument to tell you. What if I were to tell you that flying blind, in one sense, was a godly principle? And what if I were to tell you that God expects us to fly blind every so often? That there are times when He wants us to be flying blind. And that we can't be pleasing to Him unless we do so. Sometimes God wants us to rely on more than what we can see. I'd like you to turn to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. We'll start reading with verse 1. It says, "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." Faith is defined as the evidence of things not seen. A pilot places his faith in the instrument when he's flying under the instrument flight rules, under IFR. You place your faith in that GPS device to get you where you want to go, even though you don't know where it is. You don't know where you're going. You place your faith in the instrument. We have no evidence that we're on the right road. The only evidence is that this is what the GPS is telling us to do, and so we follow it. Sometimes we make decisions based on the evidence we see. For example, we take with us an umbrella because it looks like it might rain. You look out your door and you see a storm cloud off in the distance. Looks like I better take an umbrella today. Maybe you heard the weather report earlier that day. The weatherman said, looks like it might rain today. That's evidence. That's the evidence that it's going to be stormy. It's going to be a rain event. And so you better take an umbrella. You make that decision based on the evidence. Or you fill your car's gas tank when the needle gets to empty. You see that you're getting low on fuel, you know it's time to refuel. You know you've driven your car over 350 miles since the last fill-up, and you know that it has a range of 400 miles, so you figure it's time. It's time to stop and refuel. This is the evidence that you need gas. The evidence is the needle is showing it's getting close to the E, and you know that you've driven a lot of miles since you filled up. So that's the evidence that you need to stop and get some gas. These are physically visible forms of evidence that we see. But sometimes things aren't physically visible. Sometimes there is no physical evidence, like when you're going through a trial with seemingly no way out. But you go on because you know that God is going to get you through it. You continue because you have faith. You have the evidence that it's going to be okay. This evidence is your faith. There are decisions that we can't make based on physical evidence. Our faith is the evidence that we need to make the right decision. And without that faith, we cannot please God. Let's look at verse 6. Same chapter, Hebrews 11. We'll drop down to verse 6. It says, "But without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him." Without faith, we cannot please God. Hebrews 11 has been referred to as the faith chapter. And as you read on through this chapter, you see several individuals listed here whose faith was very strong. Let's look at verse 7. It says, "By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith." Now God told Noah, he said, "Noah, I want you to build me a big boat. I want you to build me a boat that is so big that you will be able to carry all kinds of animals on this boat, that you'll be able to take your family on this boat. and anyone else who feels like they need to be saved from what is coming. Now, Noah was called a preacher of righteousness. We read that in 2 Peter 2, verse 5. Apparently, Noah preached to the people of his community, the people of his area, preached about God, preached about righteousness, preached about faith. And he may have had a following. We don't know. The Bible doesn't really tell us. It doesn't tell us how many people followed him or listened to him, how many he preached to. It just says he was a preacher of righteousness. But I would imagine when he started building that boat, that he was probably ridiculed by the community. And here he is, building a boat, no indication that it was near the water. It may have been somewhere on dry land for all we know. And back in those days, sure, they had boats. They went out on the sea. They could sail. They had built boats before, but you know, when you built a boat back then, you had to build it near the water's edge. You had to build it someplace where at some point the tide is going to come in or the water's going to come up and it's going to be able to float that boat. Because let's face it, back then they didn't have SUVs with trailers and you couldn't haul your boat around to a boat ramp someplace and launch it. It just didn't work that way. You built the boat, you had to be right there on the water. You had to be somewhere where it was going to be able to float away when the water rose. So perhaps Noah took a lot of criticism, a lot of ridicule, a lot of people just laughing at him for building such a boat. And when he told them, God is displeased with mankind and he is going to destroy mankind, what do you think they thought? Destroy mankind with a flood? Are you serious? I think we know that no one but Noah's family got on that boat. So nobody believed him. After all, there was no sign of rain. There was no sign that there was going to be any flood coming. Now, it took quite a while to build this ark. It took them a long time. It's not like he started building it because the weather forecast said it was going to rain. I mean, even today, we can't foretell the weather a year ahead of time. There was no physical evidence that such a project was needed. But you know what? Noah had all the evidence he needed. He had the evidence he needed. Evidence of something unseen. Where was the evidence that such a vessel would be needed? Noah didn't evaluate the need from past weather patterns. He didn't evaluate what the weather had been for the last few years and say, oh, I think there's going to be a flood this year and the pattern is pointing toward it. No, he didn't do that. He didn't assess whether the project was cost effective. You know, today you wouldn't think about a construction project unless you knew that it was cost effective, but that didn't come into the equation. That wasn't part of the evidence that he needed. Did Noah see evidence that an ark was necessary? Yes, he did. But that evidence wasn't physical, tangible evidence. That evidence was his faith. God said it was going to happen, he believed it, and he went with it. And that was all the evidence he needed to make the decision to build the ark. And so Noah was a very faithful man. And he proved his faith by acting upon the evidence that was presented. Fast forward a few generations, and we come to the time of Abraham. Abraham, who at the time was known as Abram. God hadn't changed his name yet. Abram proved to be faithful on more than one occasion. There was an instance where God told him to leave his country and go to another place. Pack up and move. Now, apparently, Abram was a wealthy man. Let's read Genesis 12, verse 1 through 5. Apparently, Abram had some possessions. He had some wealth. Genesis 12, verse 1. Now the Lord had said to Abram, "Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Then Abram took Sarai his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran. And they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. We see here that Abram had possessions. He took those possessions with him. It also seems as though he had slaves, or perhaps what we would term employees, because it says he also took the people whom they had acquired. So he had people that were working for him, and he took them as well. Was it a wise decision to just pick up and relocate? To go off to a country that he knew nothing about? A place where he'd never been? Didn't even know where he was going, because God said it was just to a land that I will show you. Doesn't say that he even told him where he was going. Where was the evidence that this was a good move? Where was the evidence that Abram was doing the right thing? He went as God commanded without question. He packed up and he went. He departed. And he followed God's lead to this new land. He didn't need to do a due diligence study to find out what this land was like and what the prospects were for his business. Whatever his business was at the time. He didn't have to evaluate the area to see what kind of people lived there, if there was a market for anything, if he would be able to survive there. No, he just packed up and went. God told him his name would be great. He said, "Don't worry, I will take care of you. I will make your name a great name." Was it a good move? Abram had all the evidence he needed. He had faith in God. He believed God. He believed it when God said, "I will make your name great." And that's all the evidence he needed. Because faith is the evidence of things not seen. Years later, after his name had changed to Abraham, God tested him one more time. Told him to go and sacrifice his only son. The son that he loved. Genesis 22, verse 1. Now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, "Abraham?" And he said, "Here I am." Then he said, "Take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son. And he split the wood for the burnt offering, and arose, and went to the place of which God had told him. What he was told to do defies human logic. There is no way in this world you can justify doing what God told him to do. He told him to sacrifice his son. And notice when he told him that, go back and look at verse 1 again, or verse 2 that is, where he said, take now your son, your only son, Isaac. He's emphasizing that this is your only son. Do you still have the faith that I'm going to make you a great nation? This is your only son, the son I gave to you in your old age. You know, I'm sure Abraham knew there weren't any other kids coming. Isaac was a miracle. He was a miracle baby. Sarah was 90 years old. Abraham was 100 when Isaac was born. That just doesn't happen. Didn't even happen back then. Life expectancy was a little longer then, but you still weren't bearing children at that age. He knew that through him was to be a multitude of descendants. But God is saying, sacrifice your son, your only son. Emphasizing that to him. And then notice the next three words, God emphasizes something else. Whom you love. He told him to go and sacrifice the son that he loved. He reminded him how much he loved that young man. And I'm sure it was a difficult thing for Abraham. But he knew that God was faithful. And he knew that he was going to remain faithful to God. There was no physical evidence to indicate this was the right thing to do. No physical evidence whatsoever. But Abraham didn't hesitate. He set out to obey God. He had faith that God would provide a lamb. He had faith, and that was all the evidence he needed. Verse 6. So Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. And he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and the two of them went together. But Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, my father. And he said, here I am, my son. Then he said, look, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham said, my son, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering. So the two of them went together. Abraham had faith that God was going to provide something to take care of the sacrifice. His faith was all the evidence he needed. Hebrews 11, verse 17. I'm sure that the very fact that Isaac existed, the miracle baby, the fact that Isaac was there, his son of his old age, was more than enough to show Abraham what God was capable of doing. And I'm sure that that played a part in causing him to be faithful. I'm sure that that played a part in helping him to understand that God is able to do anything. Hebrews 11, verse 17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called. Concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. God gave Abraham and Sarah this son. Received him, as it says, in a figurative sense, as though from a dead man, meaning from an old man, from a man who was beyond the age of having a son. Abraham knew that Isaac was to be the father of those nations that would come from him. He knew that his descendants would come through Isaac. Sarah is also listed here as being faithful. Let's back up a few verses to verse 11. Hebrews 11, verse 11, it says, "By faith Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him faithful who had promised." Now I'm sure that Sarah had seen God's hand many times, and I'm sure that she knew that God could do what he promised he would do, no matter what. "Therefore from one man," verse 12, "and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore." Abraham and Sarah both knew that God was capable of performing this. She knew that God was capable of giving her a son. Sure, she laughed at first. She laughed when she first heard the idea that she would bear a son. That's why Isaac was called Isaac, because Isaac means laughter. That's his name. And that's why he was named that, because she laughed when she was first told that she would have a son. "Who, me? Come on. I'm in my 80s. "No, you're going to have a son," God said. And when she was 90, she did. She learned that God was serious and that he was going to do it. And I'm sure she needed extra strength to get through it. But she relied on God to give her that strength. And she made it through. She knew God's promise was sure, and she went forward with it. She went forward and she had that son. She gave birth at age 90. Verse 24. We read of another individual who was strong in faith. Verse 24, "By faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin." Now Moses had a high position in Pharaoh's house. If you recall the story, Moses, when he was just a few days old, was wrapped up and put in a basket and let to float down the river. And he was retrieved by Pharaoh's daughter, who raised him, who adopted him as her own. But as time went on, Moses knew his heritage, and he knew where God's people were. And they were the ones who were slaves in the land. Moses chose to be numbered with the slaves rather than to be with royalty. That's a pretty foolish move based on physical evidence. It'd be pretty foolish for somebody to say, "Well, I'd rather be one of the slaves than be the grandson of the king." Stupid thing to do, really, if you're going by physical evidence only. Moses wasn't going by physical evidence. He had faith, and his faith made it evident where he needed to be. He had faith, and he knew God, and he knew where God's people were. Verse 27. It says, "By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible." By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. He knew who God's people were. He knew what God's power was. And he believed and he followed God and he had faith in him. He saw things that were invisible to the carnal man. He saw things that were unseen, invisible to human beings. His faith made things evident to him. Seeing God's power was all the evidence he needed. His decision was made. He did not fear any man. Verse 29. By faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians attempting to do so were drowned. Moses led the nation of Israel through the desert to a place where they were trapped, to a place where they had no place to go, and an Egyptian army pursuing them from behind. No place to go. All the physical evidence points to, well, it's time to surrender. That would be the decision they would have made if it were left up to physical evidence. Nowhere to go. Moses had enough evidence to not have to worry about being trapped, to not worry that they were at the edge of the sea, with nowhere to go, nowhere to turn. The Israelites didn't think the route to the Red Sea was a wise choice. They didn't see the evidence that proved that this was their best escape. But Moses saw the evidence because Moses had faith. And Moses led his people without any concern whatsoever. When they wanted to turn back and go to Egypt, what did he say? Stand still and see the power of God. Watch what God can do. I'm going to show you what God can do. Because Moses had that evidence. There were others who endured great trials because of their faith. We're in Hebrews 11. Let's continue reading in verse 32. It says, "And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, and also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead, raised to life again. Some mighty works were done because of faith." Some mighty works. Men were able to do things because they saw that evidence. The evidence of things not seen, but they could see it because they had faith. They had no doubt God was capable of delivering them. They had the evidence. God would strengthen them. God would take care of them in their moment of trial. Continue reading verse 35 where we left off. "Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two. They were tempted, they were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains, in dens and caves of the earth." God didn't deliver them in every case. He didn't rescue them each time. There were martyrs. There were people who died. There were people who suffered and endured great things. Why? Did they make a wrong choice by enduring to the end? Did they make a mistake? Did they misread the evidence? Well, of course not. Of course not. They are still delivered, just not all in this life. Notice what it said here. Their resurrection is a better resurrection. Perhaps God had a specific purpose in mind for them, something specific for them in His kingdom. We don't know why God allows certain things to happen, but maybe it's to teach us. Maybe it's to help us to learn. We don't know why God allowed certain people to be martyred, but it could very well be that He has a special purpose for them. The evidence is overwhelming that God knows what He's doing. We don't always understand His methods. We don't always understand why. But we do know this, that by faith we know that He is in control. Verse 13. Back up a little ways up the page. I'll read verse 13 and 14. Referring to all these names that are listed here in Hebrews 11, it says, "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland." They died in faith, knowing that their reward was ahead of them. They saw the promises afar off. They didn't see them physically. They couldn't see the literal gates of the kingdom. They couldn't see the physical kingdom itself. They couldn't see anything about it, you know, in a physical sense. But they knew God and they saw the evidence of that kingdom. They knew that it was coming. And they lived their lives based on that evidence. Now, any decision that we make can be a foolish one if it isn't based on certain evidence. Especially in important issues, it's best to weigh all the evidence first before we make a decision on something. Sometimes you might make a decision that seems a little foolish. To someone without God's Spirit, the evidence may not be there. But you see, if we have God's Spirit, we have faith, which is all the evidence we need. That faith is the evidence that we need to make a decision sometimes. Stepping out on faith requires that we know where we're stepping. We can't always see physically where to place our feet. We just walk. We just go. We have the evidence that we're going the right way. Have you ever been faced with a situation where you just had to go on faith? You just had to proceed with faith because you couldn't see any physical evidence that you were going the right way. When you first came into the church, don't raise your hands, but how many of you were faced with a Sabbath issue when you first learned about the truth? When you first learned about the Sabbath, was it a challenge to you? Was it something that you said, well, I don't know how this is going to work? Did you have to decide between the Sabbath and your job? Maybe you were threatened with losing your job. Maybe you had a situation where you just felt like it wasn't going to work. You knew that the boss wasn't going to let you off. The physical evidence all said, hey, you need your paycheck. You can't afford to just let this go. And taking off on the Sabbath just didn't make sense physically. All the evidence pointed to the fact that this was a foolish decision to begin keeping the Sabbath. But that's the physical evidence. Maybe you said, well, certainly God wouldn't want me to lose my job. Surely God expects me to keep working. See, that's human logic. That's physical evidence. That's physical logic. Maybe you didn't have a situation where you would lose your job, but maybe you were self-employed and taking off one day, closing up shop, meant a significant reduction of income. All the evidence said, you can't afford to keep the Sabbath. You can't afford to take that extra day off. And it defied all logic to do something so foolish as to keep the Sabbath. Surely God doesn't expect me to give up my income on that day. He gave me this job. He allowed me to have it. Surely He doesn't want me to give up some of the income. Here we go again with more human logic. All the physical evidence points to keeping the Sabbath as a foolish decision. That is, the physical, visible evidence. But faith, the evidence of things unseen, makes all the difference in the world. That's what makes it different. That is what makes you choose differently. That is what makes you decide, yes, I need to keep the Sabbath. Faith is what does it. That's the evidence you need. The Sabbath has been termed the test commandment. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 31. Exodus chapter 31, verse 13. It says, speak also to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbaths you shall keep. For it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. Let's read down in verse 16 and 17. Therefore the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. The Sabbath determines who God's people really are. It is a sign between God and the children of Israel. It is a sign between God and his church. And it is a test of our faith. Do we believe God or not? Do we believe that God will provide for us if we have to sacrifice to obey him? There's too many people in this world who want to do away with this commandment, that say that it isn't applicable today. They don't see that evidence of things unseen. They don't have that faith. That faith provides the evidence that we need to make the right choice. And those who choose not to keep it don't pass this test. Notice God's instruction that I just read to you in Ezekiel 13, where it refers to Sabbath, plural. Surely my Sabbaths you shall keep. How many Sabbaths are there? Now, I thought it was just one day a week, but this says Sabbaths. Isn't there only one? No, the Bible also refers to the holy days, the annual festivals, as Sabbaths. Let's look at John 19, verse 31. It's one example of where a holy day was referred to as a Sabbath. John 19:31, it says, therefore, because it was the preparation day, that the body should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day. That Sabbath was not a weekly Sabbath. That Sabbath was an annual Sabbath, a high day. Leviticus 23, verse 32. This passage is referring to the Day of Atonement. It shall be to you a Sabbath of solemn rest, and you shall afflict your souls. On the ninth day of the month at evening, from evening to evening, you shall celebrate your Sabbath. Now agreed, once in a while, this year included, the Day of Atonement does fall on the weekly Sabbath, but not always. Not always. Verse 39, referring to the Feast of Tabernacles and the last great day. Also on the 15th day of the seventh month, when you have gathered in the fruit of the land, you shall keep the feast of the Lord for 7 days. On the first day there shall be a Sabbath rest, and on the eighth day a Sabbath rest. So that term is used also to refer to annual festivals. Now maybe your job never required you to work on Saturdays anyway. Maybe you had a Monday through Friday job. And so you were never tested on the Sabbath, at least the weekly Sabbath. But the test still comes around when the holy days come. You're still tested. These days are just as important, if not more so, than the weekly Sabbath. They're very important days. And we, by faith, decide to take off on those days and rest and worship God. I mean, these days are important. This is the plan of God we're talking about. These are the days that picture and outline the plan of God. They're important days. Why is it then that some members decide not to attend? Some members think that it's not important if I go to the holy day. You know, they're there on the Sabbath every week, but on the holy day they don't show up. I've seen that happen. I've seen people not show up for the holy days. Why is it that some parents let their kids attend school on the holy days? I had a man once tell me that his son had a test. And I thought, well, you know, the holy days are a test. See if you're going to observe them or not. And then the next holy day came around, and I'm like, where's your son? He said, he had a test. And it seemed like every holy day he had a test. I couldn't understand why he had so many tests. And I realized he wasn't the one being tested. Why is it that some come to the holy day service, and when there's two services, they only attend in the morning? And in the afternoon, well, that's just not important enough, and we'll just skip the afternoon. It seems like every holy day when we have two services, there's always a higher attendance in the morning than in the afternoon. I don't get it. Leviticus chapter 23, verse 2. Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feast of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, that means commanded assemblies, these are my feasts. And then he goes on to list them and talk about them. The word feast is from the Hebrew word which means appointment. These feast days are an appointment. God has an appointment with you on these days. Or should I say, you have an appointment with God on these days. That's how important these days are. They're so important that God has made an appointment with you to be there on these days. Our faith is what tells us these days are important. Do you have the evidence to prove how important this is? What is more important than the plan of God? What in this entire universe is more important than the plan of God, which these days picture? Our faith is the evidence that we need to put this first. That this is important. And that nothing in our physical lives should come before it. I didn't mean for this to turn into a sermon on the Sabbath and the holy days. But I'm just pointing that out, that it is faith that leads us to understand the importance of these things. What did you think when you first learned about tithing? When you first heard about the principle of tithing? Oh, I don't know if I can do that. I don't know if this is going to work. Many people say they can't do it. And it's based on physical evidence. They count up all their bills and they compare it to their income. And they see what they've got. And many times it doesn't work. Because they're doing it all wrong. They're doing it wrong. They're counting up their bills and seeing what they've got to pay and checking to see what's left that they can give as tithes. That's not the way it works. You see, it's the first tenth that belongs to God. The first tenth is God. And it should come out first. And then after you've taken out your tithes, then you see what's left and you compare that to your income. And guess what? Mathematically, it still doesn't work. But when did a little math problem ever stump God? I don't think he's ever had a problem getting past a math problem. The solution can't be seen on paper. There is no physical evidence that it works. But we have God's word that it will work. Malachi 3 verse 10. Malachi 3, verse 10. It says, "Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house. And try me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it." We have God's word that it works. And our faith is all the evidence we need to act on it. God expects us to test him and see what he can do. Our faith is that evidence that it will work out. And that's regardless of what we see mathematically. Because God has ways of changing our situation so that it will work out. He has ways of increasing our income. He has ways of giving us special blessings. He has ways of reducing our expenses. He's in charge. And it is our faith that is the evidence of that. We base our decision to tithe regardless of our calculations, regardless of what it says when we do the math. We have the evidence that the budget will be balanced. That evidence may be of something unseen, but that's what faith is all about. Faith isn't acting and then just hoping for the best. Faith is acting and knowing that God is in charge and it will all work out just fine. It is evidence as hard and fast as that which we can see. We have it because God gives us this faith. God strengthens that faith in us. We've seen what he's done before. We've seen some of the things he's done in the past. So there's no question. We know that God can do what he says he will do. We've seen him act before in miraculous ways. If we stay close to God, we will see what he can do. And it will make our faith stronger if we don't let up. You know, it's kind of like going to the ocean. You're down on the beach. You start walking out to the water, and you walk into the water up to your ankles, and you go a little further, and you get up to your knees, and you keep on walking, but you start to walk a little cautiously because you don't know if there's going to be a drop-off. You don't know if the bottom's going to fall out from beneath you. So each time you take a step, you kind of put your foot out front and just kind of feel around a little bit to see if the ground is still there. And so you walk cautiously, not knowing if it's just going to drop away. Walking by faith is walking boldly forward with evidence that you have a firm footing, that you just start walking and you know that it's going to be all right. You know that God is in charge. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 6. It is that confidence, that faith that we have, that evidence of what is not seen gives us confidence. Second Corinthians 5, verse 6. So we are always confident, knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord. For we walk by faith, not by sight. We are confident, yes, well pleased, rather to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. Faith disregards what the physical evidence may show. How will your faith be tested in the years ahead? When things are going well, we might not have to rely on faith so much. We might not even think about it sometimes. If things are going well, your income is good, you've got no serious problems in your family, everything's going along just fine, you might not think about faith so much then. But what happens when times get tough? And they will. They will get tough as we move closer to the end time. Will we be able to continue walking boldly forward? Or are we going to hesitate, knowing that we don't know how deep the water is and the bottom might drop out from under us? How are you going to react when your faith is tested? You might not have a Sabbath issue with your job at this point in time. You may not have a problem tithing as God instructs. Maybe you've been doing it for years and you know that it works and you know that this is what God wants and you do it without any problem. But if your situation changes, how will you walk? If your situation down the road changes, what if the economy goes way down? What if things get a lot worse? What if you lost everything you have? What if you're facing martyrdom at some point in the future? Many have faced that, and the Bible tells us that more will as we come closer to the end. One way to ensure that your faith stays strong is to stay close to God. Stay close to the Father, stay close to Jesus Christ. Have a close contact with them. Be aware of what God can do and will do if we have faith. Faith is that evidence we need when physical evidence is not there. Faith is the evidence of things not seen, not physical, not visible. Grab hold of that faith and don't ever let go of the evidence of things not seen.